found this on Ganarum. Ganamir, me.
What is it?
Well, it's
chip for heads.
In my gravity boots, I'm stuck walking the hole with a pounding in my skull. Ain't nobody knows which way the solar wind blows. Better than a man being blown.
Welcome to Synthaholics. This is your host, David Duncan, and with me is...
Guy Davis.
Welcome, guys. Good to have you. It's been a couple episodes.
It has been. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Always. You're the third co-host, so it's just, you know, just getting the times to match up and everything.
It's kind of weird because, you know, you keep being 2 hours ahead of me. It's just so strange.
It's so strange. You know, we should be like China and just have one giant time zone.
It'd be
even Alaska and Hawaii,
California and New York were at the same time.
Well, that's how China is. It's just one big time zone.
Yeah, or even worse, Hawaii and New York.
Yeah. It'd be whacked out as far as time
bizarre.
Goes.
Everybody would be confused.
Yeah.
We'd be all lost.
But we are Synthaholics.com. You can find us on Twitter at Synthaholic Duo. I'm David_J_Duncan. Guy is Blackbird2004. Aaron is back to Blackbird2004. And Guy, you are?
I'm at GS Davis Art and GS Davis Art on Facebook and USSTamerlan.com.
Yeah,
And witchesofflame.com. Gosh, I'm everywhere.
You're everywhere. You've got so many different sites. And you're patreon.com/GSDavisArt. And
that's
to
right.
To support our show, Synthaholics, you can find us at patreon.com/Synthaholics. We just want to start throwing this stuff at the beginning just in case people are...
You know, go to sleep.
Go to sleep, you know, turn it off halfway through and never turn it on again. So this is how you can find us.
Yes. You can find us there.
Yes. So this is the many places. We're on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Music, and iHeartRadio. So you can find us and like us and review us at any of those places, which would be fantastic. But today, last time we recorded an episode, we talked about the news of Brian Fuller being totally pulled out of Star Trek Discovery. And we also talked about how CBS has fully financed Star Trek Discovery by its sale to Netflix on every single country except for the United States and Canada. So you weren't here for those discussions.
No,
what are your thoughts?
I've been reading them online. Boy, I've been reading it online.
What are your thoughts on these latest developments since you have not gotten the comment on these yet, Guy?
Well, I mean, it's really hard because we always experiment. And I remember when Voyager was coming out and we were experimenting with UPN and everybody was sure that was the reason why it wasn't so good.
We were teenagers and we were finding out about our bodies. Oh, wait, no, sorry.
Yeah, and, you know, and stuff like that. And then we were confused about whether we liked Voyager or not.
Pimples.
Anyway, but I don't know. I mean, I obviously I'm going to pay for CBS when it comes out. It's not that expensive. However, I am not ecstatic about Netflix paying for it, and we don't get to reap the benefits from that. Although I have a feeling that what's really going to happen is CBS Online's not going to work very well, and we're just going to end up watching it off of Netflix. They'll just keep it going. If it's popular, they'll just keep going with it. That's what I'm
well, –
this
I mean,
is my prediction.
Well, I mean, if you know, CBS All Access – is still going to charge us, even though they've got it paid for. I hope that means that there's for sure going to be a second season, regardless of anything, if they're reaping the money twice. They're getting it from Netflix and from the Star Trek fans in the U.S. and Canada. Hopefully that's at least some solace that we're getting at least a second season for sure. I mean, nothing's written in stone, but that's just my hope. That, I mean, since it's paid for, you know, let's hope we can get, you know, get past the first season.
A second season or...
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and the truth of the matter is we all know, being hardcore Trekkies, we've got to let it kind of fumble its way through the first season. We're just going to have to be able to accept that.
Yeah, well, hopefully, you know, with a tighter 10 to 13 episode arc, and hopefully the first season won't be fumbly.
Yeah, well, we can always hope. We do have Michelle Yeoh, and, you know...
Yeah.
I love Michelle Yeoh, and that, and the addition of her to the cast is so awesome that I am just like all on board there. Yeah. I'm like, this is cool.
That is really awesome.
Having her in every other thing she's ever been in.
Having
so.
Michelle Yeoh, I'll just think it's strange that they're casting people for not the main ship yet. I'm like, yeah, we cast someone for the other ship. I'm like, okay.
Well, that's all right. I mean, it's my thought is that we're going to have... It's going to be very...
Like, there's got to be lots of casting announcements between now and January 1st, hopefully, since they're supposed to be shooting in January.
Right. Right. Well, and that's the other thing is, I mean, yeah, and January 1st, well, that's not so far from now. So, you know.
You know, seeing as this is recording on December 11th, although this episode will be out much closer to January 1st.
So by the time you listen to this, it's going to be even worse.
Yeah. So hopefully by the time you hear this, there'll have been more casting announcements. We can yes. only hope.
Our only hope is casting announcements?
We can only hope for casting announcements. Obi-Wan Kenobi is our only hope.
Jyn Erso. Star Wars is all a new hope.
And maybe Jyn Erso is our hope for getting the Death Star plans. Who knows?
Right?
Yeah, because we're going to be doing a crossover with you guys, the Geek Tank, for Rogue One in late December or early January.
Yes, we are. It'll be the very beginning of Geek Tank's second season.
Very awesome. That'd be fun.
Yes.
But today you picked an episode of Deep Space Nine called Rocks and Shoals.
It's one of my favorites.
It is a really good episode, but like the name didn't stick out to me, and I was like, is this a TOS episode? I don't even know what series this is. So I had to Google Memory Alpha and the name of the episode. Oh, it's Deep Space Nine Networks. Love Deep Space Nine.
Yeah, it's it's one of those things. It's the informal name of the articles for the government of the United States Navy. It's their uniform military code,
yeah.
Which is what the term comes from. But it's the yardarm rules. You know, if you're treasonous, we hang you from a yardarm sort of stuff. So it's called Rocks and Shoals because it's very brutal. So
very, especially from the Vorta's perspective.
Right, and the episode is aptly named. But this is the episode for me... Even though it's the middle of an arc, this is the episode for me that made me realize that DS9 was not screwing around. They were going to get serious. People were going to, you know, and it's well done because we start with Major Kira sort of going through the motions. And,
sure. Yeah. Just
you know, she's just going through the motions every day. She goes to the two ops. She gets her coffee from a Jem'Hadar. She's just sitting there working her little buttons on her thingy on the control panel and doing her daily grind. And we get this, you know, it's almost like it's the beginning of, it's like a miniature beginning of the hero's journey for Major Kira on this particular episode. And for DS9, Major Kira is one of my favorite characters. She's always been one of my favorite characters. And Nana Visitor, by the way, is an awesome human being.
She is. She's a fantastic actress. And we actually, last time, we talked about Duet. And, I mean,
yes.
That's the first season.
I wish I was there for Duet. That's another one of my favorite
episodes.
That's
a first season episode, and it is surprisingly serious. You're like, yo, Deep Space Nine's getting serious here in the sixth season. But they got serious, you know, in season one at least once.
Yeah, well, and that's the thing is that... Duet was the first time that I'm like, oh, this is the way you're going to be. Gotcha. You know what I mean? You're sitting there thinking, oh, they're going to play around with the space station thing. And it's going to be, you know, happy-go-lucky. And this is... smacked in the head with the butcher of Galatap. And you're like, oh, okay.
And And just the acting in that episode is so phenomenal across the board. Like, especially, you know, the actor who came in to play the Butcher of Galatep and you know, Nana Visitor. Like, just they're bouncing off each other. It's just so just brilliant and well done.
It really let her shine, and that's one of my favorites. Duet's definitely one of my favorites. But this
we'll
is the episode.
We'll have to revisit it when you're free.
Yes, I would love to. So this is the 6-episode arc that starts with the sons and daughters and A Time to Stand, that are in the beginning of this little arc of the occupied DS9.
It's like the second time it's gotten occupied too, isn't it?
Yeah, and this is 6th season, so you know, the 6th season starts out with DS9 being occupied and turned over to the Cardassians and to the Dominion.
It's just so good. It's just I love how Deep Space Nine just does these arcs, and they don't even say to be continued, but like they might as well have said that, because it's just bam, you're right there.
Yeah. Yeah. And so in general, what we've got is it's got an A plot and a B plot on this, and both of them are exquisite. The A plot takes place when Captain Sisko and crew have occupied a Jem'Hadar fighter, and they are escaping from their little mission that they had wrapped up season 5 with, and they're trying to get back to Federation space when they are attacked.
More Jem'Hadar ships.
By more Jem'Hadar, who figured out who they are. And they end up taking refuge in a nebula and end up crashing on a planet.
Yeah, I love how Garak puts on the little Google glass and is like, oh, crap, hang on to stuff. We're crashing.
Yeah, because classic Jem'Hadar, there's no view screen.
No view screen. You got to put on your Google glass augmented reality.
I thought
reality.
That was kind of an interesting thing, too. An interesting statement. Only the Vorta can see. You know, I think that's...
There's so much control happening between the Dominion, the Jem'Hadar, and the Vorta. It's just so interesting and brutal in its own way.
Right.
They breed these fighters. They're 2 and 3 years old just to kill things.
Just to kill things.
And they don't let them
see.
So
on the A-plot, we still have, you know, so once they're on the planet, turns out that the Jem'Hadar fighter had also crashed with a Vorta and a contingent of Jem'Hadar. So we have sort of a standoff going on from these two on the planet. And that's your A-plot. The B-plot on this is one of those rare times where the B-plot is as good as the A-plot. Easily
it's
on this one.
But it's very rare, but like, and unfortunately, it involves prodding from Jake Sisko, which is my least favorite character.
Yes. Which is okay. Actually, Jake grows. See, that's the thing. Usually, you know, you have your Neelix /
Wesley's /
Wesley James. / you know, you have them in each one of them. But really, Jake was the weakest character, but he evolved into a very good character by 6th, 7th season. He had his own job on the show, which I thought was fascinating. Wesley just saved the day all the time, but Jake became a reporter.
At least Jake wasn't a Mary Sue. We can thank the writers for that.
Yeah. And he ended up, I mean, he had a couple of horrible episodes where they were like the one where they were trying to, where the gal was trying to suck all of his ideas out. That was bizarre.
I almost picked that as my worst part too, but I couldn't pick that one because the B plot with Luxana Troi was so good.
Yeah.
Because I love Luxana Troi. So, I mean, even though the A plot with him getting his brain juice sucked out was so bad, Luxana just saved it for me.
That's true. Well, that's another one of those. René Auberjonois was so good.
Oh, yeah.
As Odo bouncing off of Majel Barrett.
Yeah, that was
just such a wonderful, wonderful episode. But anyway, we rabbit holed. The B plot here on this episode takes place on the station, and we're watching as Major Kira is trying to, you know, hold. Major Kira at the end of season 5 becomes the representative on Deep Space Nine of Bajor. So, you know, the Federation backs out of the station, but it's still Bajoran property. So even though the Cardassians have occupied the station, she's the representative from Bajor.
She's still the liaison officer, which has never changed.
Right. Right. She's still being, you know, but instead of being the representative of Bajor to the Federation, she's the representative of Bajor to the Cardassians, because the Bajorans decided to be neutral towards the Dominion. So we've got this B plot going on where they're telling her, you're a freedom fighter. You have been a freedom fighter all your life. Why are you not fighting the Cardassians now? And she's doing those things. We get a lot of shades of what must have gone through the Nazi occupation of Germany. And you see shades of that and the French resistance and shades of all of these pieces of history where we've had individuals who hated the people that they were working with, but had to work with them because of whatever was the situation. And in this episode, we get a specific Vedic who is trying to get her. A Vedic is the Bajoran religious leader. And this Bajoran religious leader is coming to the station to try to get her to fight the Cardassians. And she's doing all of those lines you hear in the show. You know, we're just following orders. We're just, you know, all of these things that you hear in other movies and in their history books about the people who collaborated with the enemy, so to speak. And ultimately, and this is the point where I'm like, oh, I see. The Vedic ultimately hangs herself from the balcony of the promenade, saying that this, you know, to really push people into fighting the Cardassians. And I mean, she kills herself to make them push to this whole becoming freedom fighters.
Is that a peaceful protest?
Yeah, it was a very unpeaceful protest to herself.
Yes. Protest.
It was a very violent protest, but singularly violent. And that's the moment where you're like, Oh, I see.
And they keep making excuses like, oh, we'll do this meeting, but the Jemadar soldiers aren't coming. It's just a meeting. And like, you know, it's like, you know, they're like pacified and they don't even think about
they
themselves.
Haven't realized how pacified they were. And it was Vedic Yassim who's the one who is making the protest, and she ends up hanging herself. And that was just such a horrible, oh my goodness, moment.
Yeah, it's almost like it's a little bit slow-mo while it happens, and they're just like, everyone's just shocked.
I remember when I watched that episode, I remember my stomach dropped at that scene. I was like, oh, God, she's going to kill herself. And I could see her, you know, she was planning it, and I was like, you could see it coming.
Yeah.
And this is clearly a Ron Moore episode, because Ron Moore is so totally willing to do this kind of stuff to people.
He's a very dark writer, but I really like that. I was hoping he'd swoop in to save Star Trek Discovery when Brian Fuller decided not to do it anymore.
I'd love to see
Ronald D. Moore back on Star Trek.
I would too. But Ron Moore moved on to Battlestar Galactica, and that's why Battlestar Galactica is beautiful.
Yes, it is. But yeah, I don't remember seeing this one like as it came out, because I dropped off of Deep Space Nine on its initial run. I don't think I finished Deep Space Nine completely. I don't think I saw sixth season until I pirated all the shows before Netflix came out with all the shows.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, wow, this is really good. But yeah, I didn't see this episode until I was already an adult. Because, I mean, when we were talking about Duet, I was 9 when Duet came out. So.
Well, we've talked before about the age difference between. Yeah, I was in my 20s during all of this. I was in my late 20s during DS9. So. I remember, you know, I'm not much different now than I was in my late 20s. So
yeah.
You know, I remember the feeling, and I remember watching, you know, Vedic Yassim as she preps to throw herself off the balcony. And I remember thinking, oh, God, she's going to hang herself, you know. But then we end up, as if that wasn't bad enough, then we go back to our A story on this, where we've got Sisko and crew on the planet, and the Vorta is injured. The Vorta, being the leader of the Jem'Hadar, is injured. And so the Vorta has a meeting with Sisko where he explains that there's only one bottle of Kitrasel White left. And once the bottle's gone, all of the Jem'Hadar are going to kill everybody, including the Vorta. So the Vorta ultimately sets up an ambush where the Starfleet officers will kill all of the Jem'Hadar. And in exchange, the Vorta will be captured by the Federation, where the Vorta knows he will spend the rest of the war in a cushy little prison cell being fed and everything and being warm.
It's better than sitting in the cave.
Which disgusts Sisko, and it's a disgusting sort of thing, but it's, again, another one of those shades of World War II, shades of Nazism, shades of the way that everything fell down at the end of World War II.
Sure. I mean, it's bad, but at the same time, it's kind of like, well, at least he's not going to kill you. I mean, it's terrible that he's doing that to his men, but at the same time, he's basically saving Sisko's life.
Right. Well, and totally. And yeah, it's another one of those listed under, it's such a gray area. And this episode, to me, really illustrates how you can take a show and go into this very gray area about war. And this is, I mean, because war isn't black and white. It, you know, we look at war from a romanticized view. And in real life, it's all of this mushy, not squared off, gray, rough sort of environment. And of course, at the very end, Sisko even goes up to Romataclon, who's the lead Jem'Hadar, and says, you know, your Vorta set you up, right? Yeah. And he says, yep. But this is what we do, so I'm going to attack you. And Sisko's even further irritated by this whole situation because not only has
the Vorta
sold him out, but
they know and they're willing to throw their lives away.
Right. And it's like they're willing to throw their lives away and they end up in an obviously lousy situation. And more as if insult to injury, at the very end, of course, they end up losing two red shirts in this. And
that's the one.
Oh, just one red shirt. We lose one red shirt. It's been like a couple of weeks.
The woman's still alive. She didn't.
Oh, right. She just got wounded.
Yeah. Well, and Jadzia was wounded too from the beginning of the episode.
Right. Jadzia was wounded, and that was just sort of. But that's fluffy.
that was after reading the Memory Alpha. Like, oh, she had a skin condition, so they had to injure her so she couldn't be out in the sun.
Right. Right. All that really is just so that they can keep Terry Farrell from having to be in makeup for a while. Maybe she didn't want to be out in the 100-something degree weather that they were filming that in.
Well, they said she had a skin condition in the Memory Alpha, where she just couldn't be in any direct sunlight, you know, no matter how hot it was or something like that. It's just she was sick or something.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. But, man, those Jem'Hadar, those guys were hoofing it, in the 120-something degree weather, full makeup, wardrobe that doesn't breathe, and their face is entirely covered. And they were so stoic and they were fantastic actors, the guys who play the Jem'Hadar. Like just laboring under those ridiculously hot conditions, but still maintaining the weird stoicism of the Jem'Hadar.
Yeah. Which it's another one of those things. Up until this area of the story, the Jem'Hadar had just been sort of
monsters.
And they really turned this into
people.
Right. They're grayer. They're not just bad guys.
They're very gray.
They're very gray.
Shades of gray. No, not that episode.
Yeah. So it's so apparently the rubber soles of people's boots were melting in the heat.
Oh yeah.
So
it is, I couldn't believe that. And, if you see the meme where Sisko's looking really angry and hot and sweaty and he's pointing his finger, there's so many memes with that picture on it. This is the episode where that picture comes from.
And there's a reason for it. It was 128 degrees Fahrenheit or 53 degrees Celsius. That's really, really hot.
And after the Jem'Hadar led into that ambush where they're just mowed down by the crossfire, the Vorta walks up and Sisko points his gun at him. He wants to murder him. And it's.
Yeah.
Which is.
I guess the heat really
too.
Kind of helped them really become.
Really get into character.
Yeah. So
I just thought that was really, really intense and really dark because Sisko's usually always like, oh, we got to do the right thing, and he's like pointing that phaser rifle, shaking almost, Like, just like, well, I want to end that guy for just killing his men just to survive himself.
Right. And it Sisko has always been not just a, he's been since the very beginning, very much a, not just a white hat, but a very moral captain,
mm-hmm.
you know, where you're not doing the right thing because Starfleet told him to do the right thing. He's doing the right thing because he, in his core, believes that it's the right thing. And that's not to say that the other captains don't.
Sure.
But I don't think, I mean, part of this is, you know, part of the reason why I find Sisko to be one of my favorites of all of the captains is because, like Kirk, you know, the actors can't stop chewing on the scenery. But also, one of the reasons that I love about Sisko so much is that as a character, I think he would throw the prime directive out the window to save every last soul he could on a planet. If he were to come up to a planet and the planet was pre-warp technology and they were all about to kill each other, he would throw it out and go down there, phasers blasting, to stop the war. Sort of thing. I really do feel like, you know, if it was the right thing to do, I think Sisko would do it.
I can
see
that.
And I say this is inspired a lot by For the Uniform. You know, where that's the episode where we have Michael Eddington, who had joined the Maquis.
Oh, yeah. Oh, those are such and good episodes.
That is a beautiful episode. Another one of my favorites. But during that episode, what does Sisko do? He loads his torpedoes up with one of the biogenic weapons and shoots it at a Maquis base, thus wiping out the atmosphere of that Maquis base and making it unlivable. He really did do that. You know, he didn't fake out. And when Eddington was like, I'm calling your bluff because you're a Starfleet captain. Oh, why'd you shoot that? You know, he's like, yeah, don't call Sisko's bluff. Sisko's not someone to call the bluff on.
Sisko doesn't play blackjack very well. He just goes and does whatever he wants to do.
Well, it's not
hit me.
That.
Hit me. I'll hit you.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, he goes in there and it's the right thing to do, even if it's not the legal thing to do. He's all about the spirit of the law, not the letter of the law. Whereas I feel like Picard's very much the letter of the law, not the spirit of the law necessarily.
Yeah, Picard's
when that
definitely
conflict comes in, Picard's going to fall towards it's the prime directive. We have to let everybody die.
Unless he's horny for a woman, and then he'll kind of throw it up then. But otherwise, he won't.
Otherwise. You know.
If there's not a woman involved, no. I'll just get rid
of
Picard.
Yes, exactly.
Insurrection.
So. So anyway, that's sort of what I'm kind of, that's where I sort of see this going, is that kind of thing. For me, I feel very much like that's one of the reasons why I really, Sisko is like very much, what am I looking for? He's fire. He's very fire.
Yes.
You know? Whereas Picard's very water and calm. You
yeah,
know.
Yeah. Picard is almost always very composed, except for the movies.
Except for when there's girls involved,
or when there's Borg involved in the movies,
or Borg.
He does get fired up over those. Borg.
But on that same token, I mean, Picard was molested. You can't knock him for that.
But the thing is, in the show, the Borg keep coming up, and he's always calm. It's just in the movie, he's not calm anymore about the Borg.
It's because that's the evolution his character should have taken, but didn't in the show.
Hmm. That's true, I guess.
In fact, I mean, that's pretty much not word for word, but what's in that 50 years of Star Trek book.
So you're saying he should have put the virus in Hugh and wiped out the Borg then?
I feel like breaking the little spaceship scene would have fit in Hugh. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That. I feel like the point where, you know, the line must be drawn here, no farther, should have been in Hugh.
Yeah, I could see that.
I think
I mean, Guinan was basically the person, like, giving him reason in that one, too, who calms him down.
Yeah, I mean, I could see Guinan saying, look, I want to kill them just as much as you do, but...
Well, that was the fencing scene.
We hear that from Picard in in the movies, we hear him say, you know, he lost his agency. He lost his, you know, he lost his rights. He lost it. He was attacked. He was raped effectively.
Mm-hmm.
And that's traumatic.
Sure.
Right there.
Most definitely.
I mean, that's a horrible thing. And it, you know, it could drive that character to do that. And I think that, yeah, I think that they didn't play it up because Star Trek at the time, Next Gen had to end and begin on starting point zero so that they could all be interswapped.
Yeah.
So because of that, each episode, effectively, you had to wipe Picard's memory and start him all over again. And it couldn't, it wasn't until...
But they did reference, you know, that a lot, because he was like, I'm Locutus. He's like, he kept on doing that to Hugh. He's like, I'm Locutus. You gotta talk to me. Tell me what your deal is.
Right. Well, and they did that, but on the same, you know, they were, that was, even that was pushing it. You know, the networks didn't like that either. And it really,
people, come on.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. Really, we didn't start seeing continuity until DS9 started really working.
Yeah.
Well, and they weren't sure that that was going to even work until, and you know, that's part of what I was reading in the book,
mm-hmm.
was that when DS9 came out, I'm sorry, I keep running you over. I don't mean to keep running you over there,
dude. Oh, no, you're good.
When DS9 came out, you know, they had only 1 year when they weren't either working on TNG or working on Voyager.
And yeah, I think you said that either on our last time you were on or on your Geek Tank. I can't remember.
Yeah, it could have been either. But
or
we,
both.
Yeah, I think Geek Tank, because I did a Geek Tank episode a while back on Star Trek. But yeah, I mean, it's there was only 1 year. And then once they got into Voyager, everybody paid attention to Voyager. And nobody was paying attention to DS9. So DS9 started sneaking continuity in.
Which is fantastic. And it's, you know, Voyager should have had continuity, since the entire point of the show is they're trying to get back home. That should have been a continuous show.
Oh, it should have been. It would have been beautiful if we could have seen the Voyager slowly degrade over 7 years.
Oh, that would have been,
it would have been awesome.
Yeah, them having to figure out ways around the biogenic gel packs. It's like, oh yeah, we were out of those. We got to figure out how to bypass those.
Yeah, I mean, you know, in my vision, I would have, if it had been my show. If Voyager had been my show, by the end of it, like one warp nacelle would have been some other warp nacelle from some other ship, and it would have been like pieces of other ships glued to the hull, and you know, there would have been all kinds of stuff.
It'd
it wouldn't
like,
have come into
like half Borg, half you know.
Like half Borg. It would have like they're sitting there with they get all those Borg pieces attached to the hull. And what does she do? She gets rid of them.
She gets rid of them. Like, what?
Well, I wouldn't get rid of them.
that's more advanced technology than you could ever hope to achieve, you know, in your lifetime. And you're just like, you're just throwing it away. Like, it's a scab.
Yeah. We don't want this Borg stuff on our hull anymore.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, going into the fantasy realm, if, you know, you and I both shared a Voyager, I would have made them get home, like, season 6, so we could have a whole season of the aftermath. Of mm-hmm. What that meant to the characters and Seven and the Doctor, like what, how do they reintegrate back into regular Starfleet, and then maybe throw them off in the Dominion War in the second half of the season, something like that.
Right,
like
something that would have connected it over. And since we knew that TNG ran 7 seasons, DS9 ran 7 seasons, you could pretty much assume that Voyager was going to run 7 seasons. So I would have made it. They could make, you know, 10,000 light years in a year. So I'd make them be 8,000 light years out, or 80,000 light years out, I mean. And then they can skip a couple of times, but all of this, you know, oh, it's 70 years to get home sort of thing,
mm-hmm.
you know. Because then it would be, I can see sort of they wanted the hopelessness of 70 years being beyond their lifespan and stuff like that. But they didn't plan. Voyager wasn't planned out for that.
No, it wasn't. Like,
I mean,
it could have been like if they wanted to do a real generation ship, they could have had the first 2 seasons be like the first couple years and then skip and then make everyone old for the last couple seasons and have like the young people come up and be like, if they wanted to do like a real generation ship, that could have been interesting too.
Even that could have been and totally would have been. But even on the flip side, they could have, you know, you could have said, I mean, here's my thought. I mean, you have empty cargo bays. No. What you do is you start setting up people's houses in the cargo bays.
Yeah.
You know, you start having multi-house units and you start saying, okay, so, you know, you two are dating or whatever. When you two get married, you're going to move into one of these multi-house units and start having babies. Because right now we're looking at needing to replace our crew within the next, I mean, you know, right, because you've got a crew now that's stuck at their job.
Within 20 years.
Right. You've got a crew that's stuck at their job now,
and we
stuck at their control panel for 20 years.
And we had, what, two babies born on Voyager? And then we had the three Borg kids.
Right. I mean,
really? In 7 years? In 7 years, that's all that happened. And one of the babies was Naomi, who she was impregnated. Her mom was impregnated before Voyager left the Alpha Quadrant. So that doesn't even, that doesn't even count.
Yeah, I mean, really, honestly, there should have been encouragement to pair up and have children.
Like, really fast. Like, oh,
yeah.
It's going to take a long time.
You know, well, we did get Tom and B'Elanna.
Yeah, so that's the second baby I was talking about.
That's the second baby, but that's it.
Yeah.
We got two babies, and you're right, the Borg kids, and that's it.
Yeah, and only one was conceived on Voyager. So, I mean, you can't even really count Naomi since she was conceived before it happened.
Right, right.
So bizarre. But, I mean,
Tom and B'Elanna should have been the way it was working.
Yeah.
You know, that should have been the normalcy on the show. There should have been a number of pregnant women on the show because they should be thinking ahead to replace their crew. They've got 70 years before they're going to be home.
Theoretically, but then, you know, of course, they get home.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it didn't happen that way, but, you know, still, when Voyager shows up back in the Alpha Quadrant at Earth, there should be like 20 new kids on board.
At least.
You know? Or 40 new kids. Well, it only has a crew of like 100 and something, 150 or 170.
Yeah, you know, some aliens might genetically just, you know, procreate more than one child at a time.
Yeah,
we don't know how all the aliens.
I mean, you might have more babies than one.
Especially if there's a Tellarite on that ship. I mean, you know, they're pigs. They only have like six or seven at a time. You know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not, and so, I mean, not that we ever saw a Tellarite, but, you know, just throwing it out there.
Just saying. I keep thinking about that. I'm like, we missed something there. Not only that, I really do think that they dropped the ball hardcore with just integrating the Maquis crew, and then everything's fine.
Well, yeah, they did that. But I mean, as soon as everything was fine, they should have started having kids. I mean, I understand maybe since the tensions are tight, they're integrating the Maquis crew. You know, maybe they don't want to have kids while, you know, they're scared their crewmates might stab them in the back. But once it was fine, they should have started. And yeah, it was really silly that how fast that just dropped off. Oh, everything's fine now.
Yeah, I mean, I almost would have said it would have been a little silly, but it almost would have been kind of an interesting thing to add some of the social experiments that occur whenever you have two groups that are dispergent together.
Yeah.
Stuck together.
Could have been a Romeo and Juliet type of thing. You were a Maquis and a Federation
bomb. Yeah, you could have had entire Romeo and Juliet.
They could have totally
done
Romeo and Juliet.
They could have done Tom and B'Elanna as Romeo and Juliet and just run that to the end. Not necessarily to the killing each other stage, but, you know, it's the same kind of thing. We've got two dispergent groups that don't like each other.
In close quarters.
In close quarters. There's a lot of instances of that happening in the history of not just our country, but other countries and elsewhere in the world. So, I mean, you could have explored a lot there that they let drop.
Yeah, no doubt.
And this is all coming from Rocks and Shoals, ladies and gentlemen.
Yes. Yes. We rabbit hole into rabbit holes and the rabbit holes.
We're not even on the same series anymore.
Nope. We just diverted into a general Voyager discussion. Well, it's fine because, I mean,
which is fine.
Last week we did do Duet, and we haven't done Voyager in a while. I think last time we did Voyager was the Halloween one.
Yeah, we'll need to, you know, we should pick up on Voyager somewhere along the line. I've got a couple of favorites out of Voyager that I would love to talk about.
Sure, yeah, we'll get those and we'll do those sometime soon. Probably
because I am a very open and accepting Trekkie. I don't I, I don't I, I have my gripes about the shows, but that doesn't stop me from watching all of them over and over and over. So
that's very, very true. I gripe and I still watch them. So I love them. But, you know, but the gripes are more for like, oh, it could have been so much better. It's not that I hate it, just that it could have been so much better.
There's nothing wrong with what you guys did. It's just that you could have done better on this one.
My imagination just surpasses what actually can happen a lot of times.
And I think that that book that I keep referring to, the one nice thing about it is that I read in that book that even Brandon Braga and Rick Berman and a number of them, even they feel like they didn't do enough justice to some of these shows in the exact same feelings. I mean, even they say, gosh, I wish we had gone further with the Maquis and the you know. And really the only one that I feel like they don't have that they're off base on is that I don't think Rick Berman liked DS9 that much. Which brings us full circle and back here onto DS9, because the truth of the matter is I feel like they did beautiful with DS9.
DS9 is by far my favorite series. Like
mine too.
Head and shoulders, because it was different than all the other ones. They did have these long arcs. I mean, basically season like 4 to 7 is one giant arc in Deep Space Nine. Granted, yeah, there's smaller arcs inside of it, but it's very much continuous.
Oh yeah, they're moving towards, I mean, you pretty much start the fourth season and you don't even really need to, you just roll. You just keep going with the fourth season until you get to the end.
Yeah, you know? And it's just a one big long amazing story, and it's so well done. Like, I mean, you know, it's Game of Thrones before Game of Thrones, you know. That type of television. And then, you know, and then after that you had Battlestar Galactica, which was pretty contiguous until seasons 3 and 4, which
season got 3 weird.
Like, they got Star Trek-y, and I mean that in a derogatory way, which is really weird.
Yeah.
But, like, the first two seasons...
Being Trekkies, that's kind of weird for us to really say, weird. But I completely concur.
It's like the first two seasons, really strong arcs. Second, in seasons 3 and 4, were just Star Trek-y. They had no continuity with them at all. Like,
Alien of the Week.
They're supposed to be scared of the Borg, they're supposed to be scared of the Cylons coming after them. And they're like, nah, we're going to go on strike because working conditions are bad. Is working conditions worse than, like, being dead? Like, really?
Yeah.
Like, and then, like, all the lawyering that was happening. I'm just like, I mean, I love the guy who played the lawyer who was Badger in Firefly, but I just was
We love Badger.
I love Badger. It's just like, why? Like, they're wasting all this time. They're supposed to be on the run for their life, and they're just, like, screwing around. I'm like, why did you get Star Trek?
I am amazed. That we, you know, referring to Badger, I just saw something pop up on my news feed and a figurine of Yosef Bridge. And I thought, God, this show, Firefly, ran 13 frickin' episodes. And yet,
not all of them aired on TV.
Yeah, here we are almost 15 years later, still talking about those 13 episodes that we love so dearly. Because they did such a freaking good job. I mean, it was just so wonderful.
It was really beautiful. I'm so sad that Ron Glass died.
Yeah, I know. That's a sad one.
And he died the same day as Fidel Castro, which is like a double whammy. It's like, oh, really? Like, the worst person in the world dies the same day one of the awesomest people in the world died? Like, come on.
Yeah, it's like, wow.
Yeah, sorry we didn't mention that like more in a more timely episode. We could have mentioned that a couple weeks ago. It slipped my mind, but yeah, it's really really
and
sad
it's
that
not
Ron
that
Glass
Ron
died.
Glass has slipped your mind. We love Ron Glass.
Yeah, it's just the fact. It's just like you don't want to deal with the fact that he's dead.
Yeah, you don't. And it's very. I don't know.
Because now, like, there's always a hope that, you know, maybe they'll do more Firefly. Maybe they'll do more Firefly. Now that Ron Glass is dead, it's like I kind of don't even hope that anymore. Because what's Firefly without Ron Glass?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, they did kill him in Serenity, but I always figured if they did another series, they'd just retcon the movie.
I don't know. That's not Whedon's way.
No.
He'd bring somebody else in. Something else would happen. We wouldn't get Wash back. We wouldn't get Shepherd Book back. You know, it's just not the way it goes. The story was about River.
Yeah. So she's
the and main he character. Wrapped the story about River, and that's why, you know, many times they talk about this, that the you know, it's River was the story piece, and so that was wrapped in Serenity, and now it's done. There's effectively 14 episodes of Firefly, and it's a complete universe, and that's kind of
Yeah, but Joss Whedon always said that the movie was basically half of season one and all of season two compressed into an hour and a half or however long the movie was.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I assume he planned more than two seasons, but you know, maybe he could do, you know, so much with it. But
they continued on in the comics.
Oh yeah, I haven't read the comics.
You should. They're wonderful.
I probably should. I'm just really bad about comics. Like I the only comics I followed for a long time, sort of, was the Star Trek ongoing, the one that follows the JJ verse of movies. And I dropped off of that, like, right out around Star Trek in the Darkness, so it's been a long time since I've been following any comics at this point.
Well, and the other comic you follow, of course, is Tamerlan, right?
Well, yeah, but I mean, as far as, like, you know, like, ones you have to, like, go and buy.
Oh, I'm just taunting you now, of course.
Yeah, I know. But I mean, but I'm talking about, like, comics that are, like, you know, like, not free to use.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's the thing. I don't know. I mean, it's I really actually rather like the IDW's alternate TOS versions, the Kelvin verse versions of Star Trek. I think that's fascinating.
Oh, they're great comics.
They're wonderful comics, and if you guys out there would like to read them, they're really, really fun, because it's this taking the episodes that we all know and love and then taking a left turn, because the crews are all
a little bit different.
The personalities are slightly different. So we get these left turns that are just brilliant.
And they summarize complete episodes in two comics, which is pretty cool.
Yeah. So heading back to
Deep Space Nine.
I was just realizing that
we haven't talked about it in about 15 minutes
in one of the two story arcs here. One of the key players is Jake, and he plays a very important part in this episode,
where he like basically starts planting in Kira and Odo's minds that they should be doing more.
Right. I mean, because he's sitting there saying, "So I'm just interviewing you, but hey, what do you think about all of this, you know, horrible stuff that's going on?" And she's like, "Shut up, Jake. Shut up, Jake."
As everyone should, because. Don't want to hear Jake
Odo,
talk.
Odo and Kira are both pretty much just saying, you know, shut up, Jake. And then when Vedic Yassim kills herself, all of a sudden it all just clicks. Major Kira.
She's like, I gotta do
something.
To
set that up.
And she's even like, I'm gonna stop you, Odo, if you try to come after me. And Odo's like, okay, hold your horses. Let me. How can I help? And how can we do this more discreetly? Thank you.
Yes. Can we do this without all of us getting killed, please?
What if I Odo like shapeshift around you? You just talk into me, and I talk into your ear, like just like do the shapeshifting merge thing, but like he just like kind of encompasses her, so no one can hear her talk, and he can just whisper into her ear. That wouldn't be conspicuous at all.
Yeah, nobody will ever notice that.
What's that weird blob doing up on the promenade? I don't know. they just shrug their shoulders and walk away.
Yeah,
Odo's too self conscious about going gooey in front of people, though.
Exactly. So we should probably also do some like key important pieces about Rocks and Shoals. It's episode 2 of season 6, production number 40510-527. It was produced in 1997 and was aired on October 6th of 97. It's the 125th or 124th episode, depending on which way you look at this. It's the 125th produced and the 124th released. It's the 482nd episode of all of Star Trek.
So crazy.
Yeah. Stardate 51096.2, which takes place in 2374. There you go. And it's part of the Dominion Invasion arc. It's number 4 of 8.
That's
you go. Awesome. I got all the data out. Written by Ron Moore, directed by Michael Vahar.
Yeah, you're right. Ronald D. Moore. Oh, he's so good. Yeah. He's so good.
You can totally tell this is a Ron Moore episode. Oh, it is such a Ron Moore episode.
Although Worf's not in it. It's kind of strange for a Ron Moore episode not to have Worf in it.
Apparently, Worf was theoretically in the very, very end.
Yeah.
But yeah, they cut the scene.
They cut the scene, yeah. Worf rescues somebody. But, Ronald D. Moore always is like a big Klingon guy, so usually you'd see Worf in his episodes, I think.
Well, that's because Ron Moore is brought on to Next Gen because he's a major Trekkie. And he was hauled on to Next Gen because he knew everything about Star Trek. Well, when they started trying to expand upon Klingons, he was the one that just happened to know everything about Klingons. So he was, they kept throwing the Klingon episodes at him. And so, you know.
Which is great. I love his work in Star Trek.
Absolutely.
It's so sad, like that they hated him, and on the Voyager staff, like they wouldn't let him do anything. And if anyone agreed with them, like I keep going back to Voyager, but like I read something, if anyone agreed with him, like they were threatened to get fired if he agreed with Ron Moore. So basically, like Ron Moore got shafted off of Voyager real fast, and that's when he went and did Battlestar.
Well, it's because Ron Moore went in there saying all the things that we were talking about. We should be rolling, you know, integrated episodes with the
one-offs,
the Maquis and the Federation crews. They'll work the ship, but they're not going to work together, sort of stuff, you know. And and then they should be. He didn't like the poop heads. I forgot their names.
I'm blanking on them too. They're the Delta Quadrant Klingons.
It's because I can't stop thinking of Vorta, and they're not Vorta.
Kazon.
Yep.
Yes, so, the poop sculpture hair people.
Yeah. Yes, that's why I call them poop heads, because it looks like they. Yeah, it's not good.
Yeah.
The Kazon. He didn't like the Kazon.
But the original idea for the Kazon was awesome. They just didn't follow through with the original idea of the Kazon. They're supposed to be like radical kids with like tattoos and stuff, and they just disrespected the elders and they just stole technology. Like, that would have been really interesting. Like, they only did that in one episode where they had Nog play one of the Kazon, Kazon. But I mean, that was the idea. They were supposed to be a bunch of rambunctious kids who stole technology, and then they just made them all adults, which just really didn't work.
The Kazon needed to go.
Which I'm glad did after what, season 3 or 4?
They needed to. It took some time before they got Katie Mulgrew squared away, you know, as far as her captain. Because we hadn't. This is, of course, Ron Moore was with the show when she still had the hair problem.
Well, I think she came. He came to the show like after DS9 was done, so they were in the middle of doing that. That cliffhanger with the Pegasus, the
Equinox,
where like basically like Chakotay and her, they betray each other, and he's like, you cannot do this. The fans will not believe any of this if you make them like just be friends. If you go through with this plot where they totally betray each other, and he's totally right. Like, I just don't buy Voyager. That Voyager really falls apart for me.
Well, and that took a lot of the sting, if you'll excuse the pun, took a lot of the sting out of Scorpion 1 and 2.
Yeah.
Because in Scorpion 1 or 2, we've got Chakotay and Janeway pretending to be enemies, you know? And we knew they wouldn't be because they weren't willing to write them that way.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you had arced like Ron Moore wanted them to arc in Voyager from the get-go, and they were not necessarily betraying each other, but, you know, sort of clashing all the time and everything like that, when you got to Scorpion 1 and 2, it'd be much more believable that Chakotay would side with the Borg or side against the Borg.
Yeah.
Or, you know, not work with the Borg because Janeway wanted to work with the Borg. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It'd be a much more believable thing.
Yeah, because they just, like, you know, they just, I don't know. It just, yeah, I mentioned this when we did Scorpion way back when. Like, it just, I just don't get how they're like, oh, we're just going to, like, ignore this.
Yeah. Yeah, because Scorpion, I don't know. I mean, it's just, It wasn't believable, and it's a shame. Because Scorpion 1 and 2 is actually one of my favorites of Voyager as well. It's the first time we see Seven of Nine, which I wanted to hate Seven of Nine so badly. But
really? You wanted to hate her?
Yeah.
Why?
Well, it's because I knew what they brought her in for. They brought her in because she was boobs. And that was it. You know? That's the only – and it turns out that Jeri Ryan is just such a phenomenal actress. She is so good that she actually won me over. And I was sitting there going, you know what? I'm not messing with this. They brought in Jeri Ryan so that they could have boobs. And that's – I don't have a problem with the concept or the idea of nudity or sex in Star Trek. I do have a problem with the concept of bringing in nudity or sex to bring in more people to watch Star Trek. Yeah. That's a ridiculous thing.
But, I mean, she never had sex on the show, and she was only kind of nude once. Or, no, twice.
Yeah. But it was still – it was the same reason why we brought Jolene Blaylock in for Enterprise.
But
Jolene wasn't as powerful an actress. I mean, it's not to say that Jolene wasn't a good actress. She just wasn't as good as Jeri Ryan.
But then again, you know, when you're playing a Vulcan, you have to not – you have to sort of not act –
yeah,
acting.
Well, and Jolene, so, the benefit Jolene has is that she's a Trekkie. So, okay. You know, that helped her a lot get into being a Vulcan, because and makes her believable. She's just not as – she didn't have as much to work with, I think.
Well,
but
when
again,
when you're
brought
a Vulcan,
Jolene in for her boobs. Yeah, and
but also when you're a Vulcan, you don't – have a lot of work. I mean, Leonard Nimoy had that fear. Like, he didn't want to be, you know, typecast as an emotionless, you know, actor. So, I mean, right. it's part of, I mean, I don't think Jolene Blaylock is a bad actress, but I think they brought her in. They did bring her in for boobs, but I don't think she had any major acting experience before that, because she was a model beforehand.
Right.
But Jeri Ryan,
she was a model and a Trekkie. And like I said, we've got to give so much props for those coming in as Trekkies. It's why definitely. I like Simon Pegg so much in the new show.
Yeah, because
it's Simon Pegg and Urban.
Carl Urban.
Carl Urban.
Big Trekkie, yeah.
Yeah, they're both – they sit there on the – that's what Chris Pine was saying, was that they'll sit there and trivia each other all the way on the flight. Well, that's cool, my boy. You
know? And Chris Pine's like rolling his eyes like, shut up.
He's just rolling his eyes like, oh my God, guys. But and this is something also that they were talking about with Star Trek Discovery. They were talking about the fact that since it's on streaming, they can do the things that they cannot do in real life, like they can cuss and they can have nudity. And my thought on that one is, you know what? There's nothing wrong with nudity if you're like I figure Orion Slave Girls would have been naked if they could gotten away with Orion Slave Girls being naked.
And female Ferengis, and, you know,
female Ferengi would have been naked, and there would have been Beta Z weddings. They were all naked.
Exactly. I mean, there's things.
There's aspects.
There's
where
lots
that's
of
acceptable.
Stuff built in the Star Trek lore where nudity would be appropriate.
Right. But if they're just going to do it so that we will all watch it, that's not cool. I'm not in on that.
Well, I'm sure they're kind of straddling the line doing that 50-50, because they know Game of Thrones gets stupid numbers.
Game of Thrones does get stupid numbers, and it gets stupid numbers because there's a lot of violence and there's a lot of nudity.
Yeah, but I mean, they're still really compelling stories at the same time. So, I mean,
yeah, I love Game of Thrones.
I think they're trying to I think the streaming service is a good idea so they can be Game of Thronesy. But I don't think they should be every episode. I think only if it really, really calls for it.
But I
like the idea of having the option there.
It's like Westworld. I feel like the Westworld series has an excellent reason for nudity and plays it out correctly. That feels to me correct.
Yeah.
The hosts are robots, and they're using the nudity as a story piece.
You know, like, they have no agency or any feeling over anything, right? Because they're robots. So, I mean,
they're robots. It's like, oh gosh, we've got to put clothes on my computer.
And also, half the time, you know, they're up there is, you know, to get fixed from all the violence that has happened to them. So, I mean, why have them come up in clothes?
So it's not gratuitous in my book.
Although, I mean, I'm sure some people would say it is gratuitous, but I mean, I don't think it is, and I don't think it is either.
I agree with you. It furthers the story.
I can see some people saying it's gratuitous.
Right. Now, like I said, I mean, you know, you'd have, if it were Star Trek, I could see, on the same token, Data and all of those, certainly. In fact, as I recall, when they first found Lore, he was naked. We had naked Lore butt.
Yeah.
In the first, you know, of course, naked Lore butt was only because they only had that part of his torso, but it was still, I totally see that. Q, when he was stripped of his powers, was also stripped of his clothes. This is a totally reasonable thing for them to have had nudity for. Star Trek has played close and careful to that line a long time. Vulcans, I can't see Vulcans thinking that it's totally logical to have to be dressed all the time if there's a scene that calls for them not to be dressed. I could see that. I can also
see them not being like ashamed of being naked. They're just like,
right.
They would just roll off their back.
It's just like, okay. You know, it's not going to bother them. That's not their problem. They don't have an issue with it. So there is call for it that I think is totally acceptable. The thing I don't know if I'm willing to accept, though, is language.
Yeah, language doesn't belong in Star Trek. I mean, sure, Bones said damn it. But, I mean, like, at this point, you know, in the swear world, like, damn is almost not even a swear word anymore.
Right. Well, and not only that, the only time that we've ever had real language
in
Star Trek, it's always been played as a joke.
Exactly.
And having a character cursing will literally be hysterical. It'll be just funny. It will play. All of us Trekkies will be laughing at it.
If they continue that trend where like a swear word is funny in Star Trek Discovery, that'd be fine. But if everyone just like damn shit fuck just because they're upset or angry all the time, is just like that's not compelling.
It's going to be really weird.
Yeah,
like and if, it's if, almost if they're, like the universe that we live in Star Trek. The words aren't the same. They're not speaking the same English we speak or something. Yeah. You know what I mean? It's almost – I feel almost like Star Trek has always been kind of – it's like we're listening through a universal translator.
Sure.
You know what I mean? Yeah. So they don't curse, not because there's no they don't want to curse or they're goody two-shoes or whatever. They don't curse because it's not words that's – in the current lexicon of English.
And it also doesn't help when you're communicating with aliens. Like these are words that are just there to be upsetting or derogatory when they're used a certain way. So you're there's right. no, I mean, especially when you're making first contact with aliens, you want to be very direct with them. You know, I mean, there's that one alien race that Wesley had to deal with when he was, you know, that you have to be super affirmative with them or, you know, almost angry at them because they don't respond positively any other way.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that's like one alien that we only saw once ever. So, I mean, it's not like that. That comes up often.
So I feel like nudity is acceptable, but language is not.
Yeah, unless they're going to make it a joke like they did in Star Trek Beyond or, you know.
Or Generations.
Generations. I mean, as long as it's in the context where it's like going to be like a funny scene, that's fine. But if it's there to be dark and gritty... No. Star Trek doesn't need to be...
Star Trek's really not dark and gritty. Star Trek is hopeful and bright.
Star Trek doesn't need
and
to be dark
and
gritty.
And when it goes dark and gritty, like it does in DS9, hey, look, we brought us back to DS9.
It happens once in a while.
When it does go dark and gritty, you kind of have to have... You kind of have to almost say, this is a side story. It doesn't belong in Star Trek necessarily. It's a side story that occurred. But while we're here, our happy people are out there on the other set of Star Trek, out there in the real world, doing their thing.
Sure. Yeah. Star Trek
and the war is
gritty,
over.
But they didn't like
at
use
some point
language
time.
To make it dark and gritty.
Yeah.
Using language to make it dark and gritty is not great.
I concur. So that's our thought process on language.
Yay, language. Because we can speak it, at least one of them.
One. Yeah. So I don't know. I Now we've covered all kinds of stuff. Boy, we've gone everywhere.
We've gone everywhere. It's been a very fun discussion.
I agree. Thank you very much for letting me ramble and rabbit hole a lot.
And I did the same, and I was bouncing off your rabbit holes into other rabbit holes.
So. I think this is almost wormholes.
Wormholes. So many rabbit holes.
We've been wormholing.
Wormholing. Yes. All over the Alpha Quadrant.
Yeah, we... And
they're the very unstable, unstable.
And the Delta Quadrant. Yeah, holy that too. Crap, we've been everywhere.
And the Gamma Quadrant.
We just you know that time that Sulu was flying the Excelsior? And there we go. Now we've added the Beta Quadrant, too. So we've got them all.
we've covered our bases today, guys. So that is fantastic. But did we have any other behind-the-scenes stuff to talk about for Rocks and Shoals?
Rocks and Shoals.
I think we kind of covered most of it. Yeah, Terry Fiddler had a skin condition, and it was hot.
It was filmed at a rock quarry in Sun Valley, north of L.A.
In the desert.
Which it's the same place they used for Cardassia 4 in Homecoming, and Desaria in Indiscretion, and Torga 4 in The Ship. The quarry does contain water, but they digitally added the ocean later. Apparently.
Oh yeah, I have the sinking gym.
Yeah, the sinking ship in the background and stuff like that. So if you watch the episode, do note the Jem'Hadar's eyes because they're very red because the makeup kept dripping into their eyes as they were sweating because of the heat, the immense heat on that. On there.
I also thought it was funny that at the beginning they had Nog swimming. I'm like, that's really weird. I'm surprised his makeup isn't just melting off from him being in the water.
Yeah.
Props to the makeup guy on that
it's
one.
Really good stuff. Spirit gum is nasty.
Well, that was very good. Well, thank you all for listening. Thank you, Guy, for joining us. And
thank you for having me.
Live long and prosper, one and all.
Yes. Peace and long life.
Peace among love. You can sink and we'll cry till we laugh, and we'll both shit our pants. You're the best drinking friend.